Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from Vassar Brothers Medical Center, the only hospital between Yonkers and Canada offering Makoplasty, the newest robotic surgical system for hip replacement and partial knee resurfacing. health-quest.org/VBMC ortho.
Well, welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us in the studio today, and we're lucky to have him, is Dr. Michael Schrum. He comes to us from Ellis Ear, Nose, and Throat in Schenectady in Clifton Park. He specializes in the medical and surgical treatment of ear disease, nasal and sinus disease, head and neck surgery, and general otolaryngology. Dr. Schrum earned his medical degree from the University of Miami School of Medicine, has a PhD in addition from SUNY Downstate Medical Center. He completed his residency at Albany Medical Center and is board certified by the American Board of Otolaryngology. Dr. Schrum, welcome to Medical Monday.
Thank you, Alan.
It's great to have you here. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. So if you have ears or if you have a throat, or if you have a nose, any of those combinations of permutations, feel free to absolutely call us up and ask your question. Many people have it. What are the sure signs that you've got a hearing problem, Doc? I was telling you earlier that when my kids and wife are in the house, they say, "You're deaf." And I say, "How do you know?" And they say, "The television is too loud."
Most people actually are not aware of the magnitude of their own hearing loss until someone else tells them. Often people with hearing loss have issues with ringing in the ears, what medically we call tinnitus.
Yes.
And that can often be a sign, but people don't realize the magnitude of the hearing problem.
Right. How did it get to be those three things, the ear, the throat, and the nose?
Well, at one time, it was actually eye, ear, nose, and throat.
Yeah.
The first specialty board in medicine was the American Board of Otolaryngology and Ophthalmology. And perhaps up until the 1950s, people did practice all four areas. The last people that did that have long since retired, and in the 1970, I believe, is when the two boards officially separated.
We have an email, and we have three people on the phone, so I'll read the email first. For the last 8 months, Dr. Schrum, I've had a chronic sore throat. My ENT scoped my throat and concluded it was caused by acid reflux. My gastro has put me through every conceivable test and remedy for reflux. Her conclusion is that I do not have reflux. But I still have a chronic sore throat. Should I consult with an ENT again? And what should he or she be looking for? Many thanks. Chris in New Windsor.
Acid reflux disease is something that we commonly see. And we often have a little bit of a difference of opinion with the gastroenterologists as to what constitutes significant reflux. The definition recognized by most GI specialists when they do pH monitoring is the number of times that the pH drops below pH 4. A normal stomach has a pH of about 1 to 2, and since the pH is a logarithmic scale, pH 4 can be as much as 1,000 times weaker acid. However, if you were to sit down and drink a glass of vinegar, that's about pH 5.5. which the GI doctors wouldn't consider to be significant reflux, but most people would not sit down and drink a glass of vinegar.
I love it when you guys fight with each other. This is terrific. Yeah.
So there can be significant symptoms that come from acid reflux into the throat of things that would be considered negligible or marginal in terms of the amount of acid. We all probably have some acid reflux once in a while. Most of us tolerate it well, but occasionally it can get a foothold and then it can take some effort to make it go away.
I find that if I gain anywhere from 5 to 10 pounds, that pushes up on the abdomen. That gives me the acid reflux. Does that sound reasonable?
That's certainly one of the issues. You know, what many people don't realize is that acid reflux is two words and it's two separate problems. We have medicines for acid.
Yeah.
We have no medicines for reflux, that is, things going up instead of down.
But there is surgery, right, that you can tighten things up?
There is surgery. It is generally reserved for those people whose symptoms are simply not managed in conservative or medical ways.
Not for me. Okay, we've got a Ray in Great Barrington, 1-800-348-2551. Ray, you're on.
Hello, Alan.
Hey.
I have Behçet syndrome, which can cause, does cause, all sorts of lesions and problems through your entire GI tract and elsewhere. This could be related to that. I don't think so, and I'm wondering about simply stress. I used to sing and play for money. I hate to, professionally, off and on. And in fact, I played with Pete a number of times. My voice has gone. I don't know whether you can tell listening to me, but it feels I've been to a doc in Pittsfield, and he shrugged his shoulders.
Okay, Ray, well, because there are other people
my
all coming
throat,
out. Yeah, go ahead.
My throat, it just feels very tight, you know, around my Adam's apple, around...
Well, Ray, we're not going to diagnose on the phone, obviously. Doc, do you have any impression that you'd like to give here?
Well, one of the things that we just mentioned, acid reflux, is frequently a cause of chronic sore throats as well as voice changes, because the main purpose of your vocal cords, your voice box, is not talking or singing. It's to act as the traffic cop that tells food to go into your stomach and air to go into your lungs.
Right.
Human beings eat and breathe through the same hole. So acid leaking up there can actually burn the back part of your throat. And when we examine people with our endoscopes, we're looking at the back part of the voice box for...
I haven't had reflux to any extent at all. And I do feel my question, I guess,
okay,
is can it be severe tension in the muscles and so on?
Well, that's a very good question, Ray. I have to tell you, Doc, I agree with the premise of the question, because when I'm very tired, my voice goes hoarse and I get a little... So can it be psychological is the question?
Let's say that there is usually some organic basis to it. There are
some very stressful situation.
There are some medical issues. One of the more common is called spasmodic dysphonia, where people actually develop spasm of the vocal cords. And the more stressed they are, the harder they try to speak, the tighter their vocal cords close to the point where they actually sound almost like they're being strangled.
Interesting. Interesting. Hey, Ray, I am so sorry not to give
you... What should I do?
Well, you have to go to an ENT
guy. You really
guy.
Need to see someone who can examine your vocal cords directly.
Yeah.
Yeah, he did.
Well, if it didn't work, go to somebody else. Hey, Ray, thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's go to Dick in Long Meadow. Dick in Long Meadow, you're on.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
With the advent of fiber optics, the ENT can do laryngoscopy right in his own office, doesn't have to go to a hospital.
Absolutely.
And I'm wondering if he could comment on that, because that can be a valuable tool to diagnose some of the cancers of the throat and larynx. And if he could comment on that, that's my question.
That has become almost a standard way of examining the vocal cords. Some of us who've been in practice for many years go back to the time when the fiber optic scopes were not widely available outside of hospitals, and we would examine the larynx with a mirror. And in most people, you can get a pretty good look. But the fiber optic telescopes, they're now quite small. They can be down as small as 3 millimeters. They can be passed with very little discomfort through the nose and examine the entire throat and pharynx directly.
Thank you, Doctor.
Dick, thanks very much for calling.
Yep.
Okay, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
support comes from Middletown Medical's Pediatric Express, walk-in urgent care for children in Chester with a pediatrician available weeknights until 9 p.m. MiddletownMedical.com. Snow Farm, Williamsburg, Massachusetts, a New England craft program offering weekend and week-long workshops for adults and teens in a farm setting. Registration now open for 2015 classes, snowfarm.org. Midwives of the Hudson Valley and Capital Region offering women's health care, maternity care, and home birth services throughout the Hudson Valley and Capital Regions. Midwives support WAMC.com. Mass Mocha North Adams presenting Sundance Theater Lab with Beasts of the Southern Wild screenwriter Lucy Alabar December 6th and comedian Harry Kondabolu on December 13th. MassMocha.org. And Edward Garbosik, certified financial planner serving all of Western Massachusetts, providing customized financial retirement strategies for those approaching or in retirement. Ed at HavikinWealthStrategies.com.
And we are back, thanks to Zachary, our wonderful head of otolaryngology in his place in the control room. Okay, so we have a wonderful doctor with us, and Michael Schrom from Ellis Ear, Nose, and Throat, and he is answering questions about his specialties. And we got two free phones, so use them now because they'll all be used in a second. 1-800-348-2551. Over to Alex in Clifton Park. All right, Alex, your turn.
Hi, Dr. Schrom. My name is Alex. I am a dentist in Clifton Park, and I've recently come across some research that drew a link between children 2 to 5, 6 years old with really large tonsils and a bruxism habit to behavioral problems later on in life. And the concept was that these developmental problems, I'm sorry, behavioral problems are because of decreased airflow during the nighttime. Do you have any thoughts or comments on that?
Okay, and before we go, bruxism is what? The chewing down of your your enamel? Yeah.
Yes, it's the grinding of teeth.
Gotcha.
The two major reasons that we remove tonsils are recurrent infections and airway difficulties. Mm-hmm. And most children, their tonsils start to enlarge around 2 or 3, continue to enlarge until around 11 or 12. Some children develop enlargement to the point where it actually obstructs their breathing, particularly at night when the muscles that they use to hold their throat open relax. And we call that sleep apnea. Now, of course, sleep apnea in adults can have a lot of other issues, but in children, most of the time it's due to enlargement of tonsils and adenoids. When that happens at night, if you block your breathing, your brain doesn't get as much oxygen as it expects, and therefore it wakes you up. When it wakes you up, you go from the deeper stages of sleep to the less restful stages of sleep, and that can result in chronic fatigue. Now, sometimes fatigue in children can be manifest as irritability, lack of concentration. So while I'm not necessarily going to say that all children with large tonsils are at risk for developing ADD, they certainly do have an issue with airway difficulties at night. And if it's a significant problem, loud and disruptive snoring, frequent awakenings, even bedwetting can be a sign of airway issues and sleep apnea in children. They probably should be examined by an otolaryngologist to see whether it really is an issue.
Got it.
Alex, thank you very much. Good luck.
Thank you.
Bye. Let's go to Timothy in Scotia. Timothy, you're on.
Hi, Dr. Shartok and Dr. Oh, man.
Dr. Schrom.
Schrom. Yeah. Okay, I'm a Parkinson's patient. Was diagnosed about 7 years ago, probably undiagnosed 5 to 10 years before I was diagnosed. I've been told, and I confirmed over the phone to the Parkinson's Foundation, National Parkinson's Foundation, said dehydration can be a danger in Parkinson's patients generally, and that to be rehydrated, you need both IV and oral water, not just IV. Is that true? And also, how dangerous can that dehydration be to your vocal cords and your larynx and everything, can you end up rupturing something?
No, dehydration, certainly dryness. Your entire upper respiratory tract is normally bathed by a thin, watery layer of mucus. Now, there is a subset of Parkinson's patients who develop what we call bulbar signs, which is signs of the brainstem nerves, and particularly can affect swallowing and speech.
Yes, I have speech and swallowing problems.
For those people, oral rehydration, that is just drinking, can be an issue because the muscles that are involved in swallowing don't function properly. There can be pooling of what you drink in the larynx, which can result in aspiration, that is, things going into the lungs. But it doesn't happen to all Parkinson's patients, and I would have to defer to a neurologist in terms of whether there are other issues that would separate those patients that develop those symptoms. But in general, dryness and dehydration, especially in this part of the country at this time of year, it's a problem for everyone. And we generally prefer oral rehydration for any problem over IVs because that's the way their body was put together. But in the situation where people cannot swallow adequately or at risk of aspiration, then intravenous hydration is certainly appropriate.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Timothy. And good luck. Let's go to Alice in Albany. Alice in Albany, you're on.
Hi, thank you. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about tinnitus, particularly if there are any ways to help reduce the intensity of the noise of tinnitus, like diet supplements, acupuncture. I know there's no cure, but is there ways to reduce that constant sound?
Well, unfortunately for most people who have tinnitus, they have a hearing loss of some kind.
This is ringing in the ears.
Those people who have a hearing loss, if the hearing loss itself can be treated, and there are some kinds which can be treated either surgically or occasionally medically, those people may lessen their tinnitus by treating the hearing problem. But for people who don't have a treatable cause of hearing loss, there's a lot of things on the market which have been purported to lessen tinnitus. It's better to focus on things that make it worse. For many people, caffeine makes it worse. Aspirin and aspirin-like medicines, Motrin, Advil, etc. And for a few people, even alcohol intake can make tinnitus seem worse. What we usually recommend for most people, in addition to avoiding that, is symptomatic treatment. And particularly the thing that we find most useful is something called masking, where your brain doesn't pay attention to a constant sound. You don't hear the refrigerator unless it goes on or off. And your brain suppresses constant sounds. So if you make a constant competing noise, your brain will suppress that and it'll often mask the noise that you hear. For people who are bothered by it to the point of not being able to fall asleep, we'll suggest taking an FM radio tuned between stations, sorry, Alan, and you'll find that hisses and it will give you a constant hissing noise, which will often suppress the ringing. But the truth is that for most people, there is no specific medical or surgical treatment.
And what causes it again?
We don't really know what causes it. It is frequently associated with a hearing loss, but it is not necessarily directly proportional to the hearing loss. Mm-hmm. So we have people that have a mild hearing loss and severe tinnitus, and we have people with severe hearing loss who only have a little bit of tinnitus.
And in terms of what you just said, would white noise, those machines, would that help you?
Yes, but in fact, an FM radio between stations is broadband noise, and it actually will act the same thing, a lot less expensive than buying an expensive white noise generator.
You know, no, Alan, listen, doctor, I have to tell you, we've done many of these programs on hearing, and this is the number one question. It always is. Alice, you're right on target. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Let's go to Rich in Western Massachusetts. Rich, you're on.
Yes, doctor. I hope you can hear me because of some background noise.
Yeah, some white noise. We can hardly hear you, but Zach, our wonderful engineer, is going to push up the little thing and probably help us a little bit. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, yes, I have a chronic problem with one of my sinuses. It gets congested almost every night or day, and it interferes with my sleep. I'm on some standard anti-allergy medications, including prescription like Flonase, but I find that since this causes headaches quite frequently, I'm just wondering whether there's anything else you might suggest to deal with it. I went to an ENT once just so he could see if there was a structural problem. I do have somewhat of a structural problem in the one side, but he said not serious enough to do surgery. And so I'm sort of left with trying different things out, and if you had any suggestions, that'd be great.
Well, to start with, one of the issues that people frequently don't really understand the sinuses. You don't breathe through the sinuses. You breathe through the nose. The nose and sinuses are different places. So nasal congestion, stuffy nose, is not a sinus problem. It's a nasal problem. And in general, when people have a one-sided problem breathing through their nose, it is often something that if we can't treat it adequately with medication, then it may be something which surgery can help.
Have you done that surgery, Doc?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What do you do? Do you take it out?
Well, typically it depends upon what the problem is, but in general, we often find that people have a deviated septum. That is, the wall between the two sides of the nose is not perfectly straight. Now, if you look at 1,000 people, you find 900 crooked septums, and most of those people wouldn't be any better off. But when it's causing a significant problem breathing on one side, then it can be straightened. The other thing which is fairly common...
The septum can be straightened?
Yes.
Oh, interesting.
The other thing which is commonly an issue is there are three little folds of skin and bone called turbinates on each side of your nose. They act like the fins of a radiator to help warm, humidify, and filter the air that you breathe. And sometimes they can become enlarged, often in patients who have allergies. And if it is a significant problem, there are a number of different surgical procedures that can be used to shrink them down.
Yeah. What do you think, Rich?
Okay, sounds good. This particular doctor said mine wasn't bad enough to do surgery. I'm thinking I might just have to live with it, but... know what else to say.
Okay.
Well, often it's a matter of how much it's bothering the patient as to whether it's really an issue.
Hey, Rich, thank you very much for calling. Let's go to Tom in Cohoes. Tom, you're on.
Hi, doctor. I usually notice a sensitivity in my nasal passages or sinuses to things concerning yeast, whether it be alcohol or bread products. And I was curious to know, is it possible to possibly have a yeast infection in your sinuses or nasal passages? And if so, how would that be taken care of?
Most people who have yeast or fungus in the sinuses, it is really considered to be a passenger that is present when people receive a lot of antibiotic treatment for bacterial infections, and the only thing that survives is yeast or fungus. Now, some people with immune deficiencies, cancer patients, HIV patients can develop severe invasive fungal sinus infections. But what's another issue is a concept called allergic fungal sinusitis. And it's fungus and yeast which grow there, live there. I mean, we have all kinds of things growing in our noses and throats. It's some of the worst, dirtiest parts of your body. And some people develop allergies to those organisms, and it can wind up causing symptoms within the nose and sinuses. That's something which can be detected depending upon where it is, either by endoscopic examination in the office, sometimes CT scans, and there are treatments for those problems.
And is yeast a fungus?
Fungus and yeast are basically the same organism. It is what's called a dimorphic organism. One phase of its life cycle is as a free-living, single-celled yeast, and the other phase of its life cycle is as a multicellular fungus.
Interesting. That's where your PhD comes in handy. Right?
As an ex-microbiologist, yes.
Okay, Tom, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, let's go to Jane in Latham. Jane in Latham, you're on.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was diagnosed a year ago with positional vertigo, and I had, after a very bad stomach virus, very sick for about 4 or 5 days, and I still have it, and it has been a year. I've been to, you know, a couple of different doctors, eye and ear, and they're just kind of saying, well, It the crystals in the ear and so on, and it really just takes time. Sometimes you just have to live with it. And I have. I'm really quite active, but I can't put my head to the left or to the back. without getting dizzy. And I'm just hoping that there's something somewhere that can kind of eliminate this or at least alleviate it.
What's the name, doctor? What's the name of that procedure that you do?
It's called the Epley maneuver.
The Epley maneuver, yeah.
I've seen that online, yes.
And it is a procedure which is designed to reposition the crystals. And the crystals is a bit of an oversimplification, but for practical purposes, the semicircular canals in your ear, which contain fluid, people develop what I, again simplifying it, call a calcium deposit in one of those canals. There are six. So when you move in a certain direction, you're getting five signals that tell you that you're moving one way and one person that says, oh, no, we're going somewhere else. And that's what your brain causes the dizziness. Now, it's the medical term for it is benign paroxysmal positional vertigo. The key word is benign, which means harmless.
Right.
For most people, it does subside on its own. Typically, when a patient is bothered by it for a prolonged period of time, the Epley maneuver or some other forms of physical therapy where you retrain the balance system can be quite helpful. There are a few surgical procedures which have been described for this, but in general, they've never been proven to really be that effective, at least not to outweigh the risks of surgery.
You write down Epley maneuver, Jane. I have to tell you, I had it once. I could hardly stand up out of the bed, and I went to our wonderful doctor and ENT, and one visit to the office, and he moved my head and a couple of things, and I stood up and walked again. It was really great.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's
But you may not
promising.
Have the same thing I had.
Again, when people have benign positional vertigo that lasts a long time, often it doesn't respond quite that simply to a single treatment. But there are other forms of physical therapy, and you have to find a physical therapist who is particularly interested in balance disorders.
But there are some ENT guys who really are specialists in this sort of stuff, right?
Well, I think it's kind of interesting that it started out with a very bad stomach virus.
That's not something which is typically associated with it. And in medicine, we do see coincidences happening.
Yeah. Hey, Jane, thank you for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Let's go to Mike in Port Jervis. Okay, Mike, you're on.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Could you speak up, Mike?
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Great. Much better.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I just have a question, actually, for the doctor about home remedies. I wanted to ask. I know that we all know there are certain home remedies people have for the common cold, but what about for something like a nasal congestion or a chronic sinus infection? Is there a home remedy, something you might suggest, orange juice or chicken soup or some sort of home remedy for dealing with nasal congestion?
Well, again, nasal congestion is not a sinus problem. It's a nasal problem. And what some people find is a helpful thing is what we call hypertonic saline irrigations. Mm. And it's to make a salt solution which is more concentrated than the normal saline content of your body. And often the stronger salt solution will, shall we say, suction out some of the fluid that's built up in the nasal passages. And irrigating the nose once a day with a strong salt solution can be helpful. What we typically recommend is a tablespoon of sea salt, avoiding the table salt, which contains some anti-caking agents, but a tablespoon of sea salt, a teaspoon of baking soda that acts as a buffer, and a quart of distilled water. Yeah. And that kind of salt solution can help with decongestion. It can also help with people that suffer with crusting, that is the dried out remnants of mucus in the nose, particularly in the wintertime.
And so, but they sell the stuff, right? Of course, instead of preparing it yourself, I tried that, Mike, and it was very hard and I couldn't keep up. But they also sell it in these little bottles, right?
Yes, they do sell saline solutions. In order to really use them effectively, you have to use it about 20 or 30 times a day because it's only water, and it doesn't last very long, for at least for moisturizing the nose.
Right. But I've always worried about those either way because, you know, the idea that bacteria could get onto the thing you're putting into your nose could create a little bit of a problem, couldn't it?
Well, you've got plenty of bacteria in your nose all the time.
Oh, yes, we all do, don't we?
And typically what we suggest is that people who are doing something like that, whatever vessel they're using, it just should be washed thoroughly.
Wipe it off. Hey, Mike, now you know what to do. Go do it, okay?
thank you very much.
Okay, let's go to Mike in Enfield, Connecticut. Mike, it's got to be short. We got a break coming up. Go ahead.
Oh, okay, I'll make it quick. Thanks, doctors, for taking the call. Doctor, I have a question about surgery for sleep apnea. I have moderate to severe sleep apnea, and I was unable to tolerate the CPAP machine. I tried it out for like 2 months, and I was wondering how effective the surgery can be. I've heard that they remove the uvula and sometimes the tonsils and adenoid and shave the back of the tongue. I'm not sure if I'm accurate with that, but I was wondering your opinion on that for taking care of sleep apnea.
For most people, the sleep apnea surgery in the short term is about 70% effective. In the long term, about 50% effective. Unfortunately, we don't do a lot of things in medicine that are only 50-50. And the definition of effectiveness is a 50% reduction in sleep apnea. So that if you have severe sleep apnea, that is greater than 30 pauses per hour, and you cut that down by 50% to 15, you still have sleep apnea. So we really try to have people work out the CPAP, you trying different masks and different settings and such with the suppliers. Those people who really don't succeed certainly are candidates for surgery, depending upon their particular problem. But it is something where we don't yet have a good test that will prove who's going to be successful and who won't.
Hey, Mike, do you sleep on your stomach or do you sleep on your back?
I actually sleep on my side. Honestly, I also think losing a little bit of weight could probably help me, too.
Absolutely.
I've heard that can be pretty effective. So I'm working on that, too. So, all right, well, thank you so much for taking the call, and I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Mike.
Okay, thanks.
We'll take a short break. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Bassett Healthcare Network, bringing heart care to the people of Herkimer, Cobleskill, Cooperstown, Oneonta, and surrounding areas. Bassett.org. The Tang Teaching Museum and Art Gallery at Skidmore College, providing exhibits, public events, and educational programs for audiences of all ages for the Capital District and beyond. 518-580-8080. Nathan Littower Hospital, Gloversville, New York. Less than 50 minutes from the Capital District, offering minimally invasive procedures for back pain with Dr. Ja'an Shen, NLH.org. And Tierra Farm Retail Stores, Madison Avenue, Albany, and Route 203, Vallation, New York. Organic nuts, dried fruit, fair trade coffee, chocolate, granola, nut butters, and gift baskets. TierraFarm.com.
Here we are with Dr. Shum. I have a question for you from Alan from Great Barrington. Wants to know, are there any cures for nose pickers?
Mittens.
That's great. Mittens. One time I saw something that was being advertised. You put something foul-smelling on your fingers. When your finger comes up to your nose, boom, there it is. Okay, let's go to Susan from Altamont. Susan from Altamont, you're on.
Good afternoon, Alan. Good afternoon, Doctor. I have a two-part question, one is similar to one of your previous callers. I've had two major sinus surgeries, and I was wondering if it can cause Meniere's disease, which I'm in PT for and have been for about 8 months. It's helped with the vertigo, but it hasn't really helped with the dizziness. And the other part of the question is, I've been recommended by my ENT doctor to have surgery because it's in both of my ears. I understand there's a whole set of other problems after that. With all different kinds of things with the eye and the ear coordination, and that I could possibly lose my hearing. Can you comment on either one of those?
Well, there is no direct connection between the sinuses and the balance system. So the short answer is that sinus surgery does not cause Meniere's syndrome.
Meniere's syndrome, just for our listeners, is middle ear problems, right?
No, it's an inner ear problem. Triad of three symptoms, a fluctuating hearing loss, tinnitus, and vertigo.
Okay.
And in terms of surgical treatment for Meniere's syndrome, there are some surgeries that have been proposed for it. And if it is involving both ears, some of the more radical surgeries, such as cutting the balance portion of the nerve that goes to the inner ear, can lead to a problem called oscillopsia, where people cannot focus their eyes because they lose both sides of their balance system. So in general, most of the time, that kind of surgery is not recommended. There are some more conservative surgical procedures which are done to, in theory, drain the fluid in the inner ear that accumulates. And there, unfortunately, was one study done in Sweden, because it would never pass muster in this country, where the surgeons did a sham operation. They made the incision and opened up the ear, but did not do the operation to drain the fluid. And just as many people improved after that sham operation as people who had the operation itself.
Is that done in the Capital District?
No. That particular kind of surgery has been done in the past. Early in my career, I did a few of them, but in fact, it's not. It's one of those things where we really try to avoid surgery. Physical therapy can be helpful. Diet, some medications, particularly medications to reduce your sodium, like diuretics, can be helpful in reducing attacks of Meniere syndrome. But most people try not to be too aggressive with surgery for Meniere syndrome.
Yeah, see, I take the Meglazine. It knocks me out for about 2 days. Is there anything milder than Meglazine that doesn't make you so incredibly sleepy?
The Meglazine is a first-generation antihistamine, and unfortunately, that's a major side effect of it. In fact, actually, in older patients, Meglazine is actually a bad idea, because the side effects can actually make patients seem worse. It doesn't treat anything. All it does is suppress symptoms. And much like Dramamine, it's useful for motion sickness, but it's really not a cure for anything.
Okay, Susan, got to go. Thank you very much. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Let's go to Tom in Williamstown. Okay, Tom, you're on.
Oh, hi. Thank you very much. I appreciate it, Dr. Rahm, that you're here. I just had a granddaughter visiting me with her family for over the holiday, and she's had a problem over the last year or more. She's 5 years old, and she chronically is clearing her throat a lot all the time, and yet she has no other signs of allergy symptoms, such as itchy eyes or runny nose or sneezing or wheezing or anything like that. So it's not really causing a breathing problem. She just chronically is clearing her throat and occasionally bringing up a little mucus and that kind of thing. And I just wondered whether she would be a good candidate for a pediatric ENT to do one of those fiber optic laryngoscope things to see whether there's any any blockage there that might be causing her to clear her throat all the time.
Often that's a symptom which can be associated with fairly common problems like enlargement of the tonsils and adenoids, which is typical in that age group, as well as actually acid reflux, which is often underestimated in children, because children don't complain to us of heartburn. They will often have other symptoms such as coughs and frequent throat clearing. And so, yes, an evaluation by an otolaryngologist would certainly be appropriate.
Can it be psychological?
Sometimes these things can have an organic origin and then become habituated.
Yeah. Interesting. Tom, great question. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it.
Have a good day.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to Dawn in Chatham. Okay, Dawn, you're on.
Hi, Alan. Hi, doctor. Thanks for taking my call. I too want to talk about the vestibular disease aspect. I was first diagnosed with Meniere's, and then they thought atypical Meniere's because I was 24/7. My symptoms were for about 16 months. Every day when I opened my eyes, my world would spin. And eventually I was sent to Johns Hopkins, where I was diagnosed with severe vestibulopathy caused by autoimmune. And then because I got migraines, the migraine spectrum got involved in all of it. But I had lost 63% of my vestibular function on my left side. And VRT, the vestibular rehab therapy, really did help. But my question is, I am in an online support group, and what seems to me is that so many people suffer, and so many people, it seems, can't find the right doctors. I feel like I was lucky, and and I wasn't lucky to get it because it was a long haul and it was so debilitating, and I lost my career over it, and I'm left with severe hyperacusis and hearing loss and tinnitus. But what is it about these vestibular diseases that, one, a lot of experts or doctors don't understand, and two, that people, you know, look at you and say, well, you look fine.
Okay, Dawn, we're going to stop there and go back to the doctor now. Doctor, first of all, I need you to do something for the rest of us. Dawn's question, the premise is on what kind of disease?
Inner ear disease.
Oh, but she called it?
Vestibulopathy.
Okay.
Two parts to the inner ear, the cochlea and the vestibule.
Gotcha.
The cochlea is responsible for hearing. The vestibular apparatus is responsible for balance.
Gotcha. Now to the answer.
The answer is, unfortunately, that the inner ear is encased in the bone of your skull. We have no way to examine it directly short of an autopsy. And that ain't worth it. I say that a little facetiously, but the reality is CAT scans, MRIs, are much too crude to view the inner workings of the inner ear. So it is often difficult to come up with a diagnosis of inner ear disorders. We can find a few serious ones, a few treatable ones, but the vast majority of things that go wrong in the inner ear, we honestly can't diagnose and treat. Unfortunately, this is one of those examples of patients assuming that physicians know more than we do. We don't have the assembly manual. We don't really know exactly what goes wrong there. And while anybody who has an inner ear problem, whether it's hearing or balance, can have symptoms involving the other function. People with Meniere syndrome do typically have problems with both hearing and balance and develop tinnitus. So that spectrum is very typical.
So Dawn reports that at Johns Hopkins he seemed to get some relief, or did I read that wrong, Dawn? Dawn? Well, Dawn's not there. Go ahead.
I'll just briefly say that for those people that have persistent balance symptoms, vestibular rehabilitation, physical therapy can be very helpful.
Really? Okay. Thanks, Dawn. Let's go to Patrick and Troy. Patrick, you're on.
Yes. Hi. Thank you both. You've covered the Meniere's pretty well in previous calls, so maybe I'll just go to my question two. Recently, or over the past few years, I've had occasion where I wake up, or I'll be just drifting off to sleep, lying down, of course, and I feel as if a bit of saliva has made it past, the epiglottis that closes off the windpipe, and I jump, you know, I start to gag on it, and I can't, you know, I just cough incessantly until I can clear it, but it seems... It's maybe a neural thing where it's just not sensing this little bit of fluid making it down my windpipe. I guess I don't know what to attribute it to.
Well, we ordinarily, believe it or not, will swallow a quart and a half of secretions from our upper respiratory tract in the course of a day.
Huh.
As nasal secretions, saliva, and you can swallow in your sleep 24 hours a day. You can swallow upside down. But what protects the windpipe is actually the vocal cords themselves. That's their main purpose.
Uh-huh.
Now, of course, people can do some things habitually, like talking when they're eating, and have things go down and pass that. But if there is a persistent problem with things going down the wrong way, which is the sort of the patient's complaint, then having it examined by an otolaryngologist is certainly an appropriate way to start.
Okay, but just an occasional occurrence is... nothing to be
too
concerned
about. If
it's
once in a while, it's not something to be too concerned about.
Okay, I feel better already.
Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Let's go to Linda in Corinth. Okay, Linda, you're on.
Hi, Alan. Thank you for taking my call.
Okay.
Doctor, I have polyps in my left ear, and I've been told I have dozens of polyps in my left ear. What is that a symptom of, or is it going to be a problem? I don't know when to switch doctors. I don't know what to do about it.
People that have polyps in the ear canal, it is usually a consequence of chronic infection. What we call external otitis, the common name is swimmer's ear, although it is not typically from swimming, but more commonly from other problems. And typically, they are treatable. Now, there are other things that can be mistaken for polyps, such as extra growths of bone in the ear canal. The medical term for that is exostoses, which paradoxically is also found in people that swim in cold water. And casual inspection can't necessarily tell the difference between a polyp, which is soft, and a bone growth, which is hard. But those are a couple of things that can be ruled out.
Okay. So that would be what I would ask for, to rule out those two particular...
Really, to just inspect and see what these polyps are.
And a second opinion never hurt anybody. Thanks, Linda.
Okay. Bye. Thank you. Bye.
Let's go to Richard Queensberry. Richard, you're on.
Yes. I got a hearing loss in one of my ears due to a nasty car accident I had back in 69. I whacked my head on the road after I rolled my car. And I'm wondering, in 69, they said there's nothing they could do about it. I have tinnitus, which is not my main problem. I just want to see if I can do something about getting my hearing back in that ear. Wonder what you can do about that. Is there something new these days that they can use?
Well, there are two major forms of hearing loss, what's called a sensory neural hearing loss and a conductive hearing loss. The sensory neural hearing loss is basically dead nerves, and we have nothing we can do to bring those back. Conductive hearing loss, having to do with the eardrum and the bones of the middle ear, can be repaired. Really depends upon exactly what type of hearing loss you have as to whether there's a treatment for it. Now, I will say that there is a surgically implantable artificial ear called the cochlear implant, which today is not indicated for people that have normal hearing in the other ear. But it has come a long way in the past 30 years, and perhaps in the near future or longer future, it may be useful in people with a single-sided hearing loss.
I can describe it. It's just the lower frequencies, I can hear about one-third as well as I used to, and the middle and upper range is essentially gone. I don't know if that indicates anything.
By itself, it doesn't. You'd really have to have a full formal audiogram, which includes both testing the nerves and the bone conduction in order to determine that.
Richard, I wish we could give you more time, but we're on our way here out of the program. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, let's go to Elizabeth in Albany. Elizabeth, you're on.
Hello, Dr. Schwam. This is Elizabeth. I was just wondering, I have mucus in my throat after eating. And
Elizabeth, could you speak up, please?
Certainly. Sorry. I have mucus in my throat after eating, which sometimes causes coughing and clearing of my throat. And I'm wondering if it's due to food allergy or something else. Do I need to see a food allergist?
Well, we all have mucus in our throat. We, as I just mentioned, swallow a quart and a half of mucus in the course of a day. Now, certainly some of that may be related to allergy, but there are a lot of other reasons, particularly when it's occurring after eating, that may be something as simple, again, as acid reflux irritating the throat and causing one of the symptoms that's frequent with acid reflux in our practice is coughing and throat clearing.
Okay, then.
Okay, Elizabeth, thank you for calling.
Okay.
Okay, let's go to Maria in Ballston Lake. Maria, you're on.
Hi. I'm calling about swallowing difficulty. It's something that I've had for a number of years. It's food generally is okay if I chew it well, but pills, small ones even, literally get stuck in my throat. And it's always in the same spot. So I was curious what might cause that, and should I have it checked out? And if so, who should I go to?
Well, that's a complaint that we frequently hear. People have no trouble eating or drinking but can't swallow pills. And I'm not sure that there's any specific findings that we see, but a general examination to see if there's normal movement of the structures of the throat can certainly be helpful. In the more severe cases, an X-ray of your swallowing system called an esophagram, where they actually have you swallow some contrast material, and often will actually have people swallow a tablet that shows up on X-ray to see where it becomes caught and whether there are any other movement problems associated with the swallowing system.
And if you're swallowing bread, which is drier, it's got to be, I find it harder than when I'm swallowing anything else. Is there a reason for that?
Well, of course, you produce saliva not really so much for digestion purposes, but actually as a lubricant.
Expedite. Yeah.
And taking sips of liquid with dry things can be helpful.
Yeah. Hey, Maria, thanks for calling. Appreciate it very much. Let's go to, really quickly, Catherine, we're out of time. What do you got?
Perfect. My ears
ears are unusually sensitive to cold, so that even brief exposure can cause excruciating pain, not unlike a migraine, but all over. Well, my head, that is.
Okay, cold ears. Go ahead, Doc.
One of the things that is sometimes a sign of is problems with the muscles that you chew with. The joint that connects your jaw with your head sits right in front of the ear, and those muscles sit on the side of your head. Your temples are your temporalis muscle, and often cold will make any muscle sore or stiff. And so that's sometimes something that happens with people that grind their teeth or clench their teeth.
Great, great answer. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Okay. We are out of time. My apologies to no one because nobody was left on the line, incredibly. I want to thank Dr. Michael Schrum for joining us today. Support for Medical Monday comes from Toprosyn Natural Medicine Formula Creams, designed to heal muscles, joints, nerves, and skin conditions, including shingles and eczema. Toprosyn.com. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Thanks to Colleen O'Connell, the wonderful Esquire, for answering the phones. Our producers, Jessica Blaustein-Marshall. I'm Alan Shartok. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Remember, the conversation continues online at WAMC.org/VoxPop. Stay tuned now for a news update.